Wi-Fi is on.
Okay. All right.
Okay, if you notice her, let me know. Here's some more sonnets. Fun, right? Yeah?
There she is.
Okay, so did you let her in?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, okay, thank you. What?
Do you have any extra
sonnets? I do. So this is just two more sonnets plus a more legible version of the Elizabeth Bishop sonnet. The one called Some Dreams They Forgot. And here is a sheet with everything fit into a single sheet. So if you don't have this yet, you can pass that to Vivi or whoever else doesn't have it. That's what you already have.
Okay.
But I brought more in for anyone who needs it. Okay, so the paper some of you asked about, and some of you didn't. Mm-hmm. So where is it? No, the paper is, I'm going to make it due November 8th, so I'm going to give you the topic on Tuesday. And it will probably, the topic will be metaphor, but it may be sonnets or maybe some combination between the two. So it partly depends on where we get today. But as I say, here are two more sonnets for you. There are three sonnets on the sheet because... Did everyone get one of these? The one that says Little Song Atop by Roan Ricardo Phillips? Okay, as long as everyone got it. Because, I gave you a more legible version of the Bishop sonnet, Some Dreams They Forgot. All right. I thought maybe... Thank you. One of the things that we were talking about on Tuesday was the way sonnets and poems that are like longer than a line or two almost inevitably start using metaphors. And there are some people who think that all language is metaphorical, and then there's some people who think that it's only metaphor, that itself would be a metaphor because all language couldn't be metaphorical or you wouldn't know what a metaphor was. But it does seem to be the case that metaphors come into language very, very quickly, and that they are very, very useful in all kinds of language for conveying thought. But sometimes in challenging thought. And again, to go back to what we've said several times in this class, the extent to which poems are about themselves, which how often are poems about themselves?
Always.
Good. To the extent that poems are about themselves, they are going to be, in some sense, metaphors for the poem itself is going to be a metaphor for whatever it is doing. And it's going to raise the question, or metaphors are going to be how whatever question a poem raises about itself, it's going to raise that question one way or another metaphorically. So one thing that I wanted to show you, every time I come here there's fewer, all right, I hope this is legible. So some of you may know this poem. If you do, don't say anything about it. But there's a two-line poem which goes, the apparition of these faces in a crowd petals on a wet black bough. So anyone recognize that poem? If you do, don't say what it is, but famous poem, often taught,
but no one recognizes it.
Okay, so one thing to notice about the poem is that it's two noun phrases. There's no verb. So what you get is the apparition of these faces in a crowd. Apparition means the visual sense of them, the visual coming into existence of them. So it's like the word appearance, except it's more active. Something can appear, you know, now appearing, or her only Waltham appearance, and then you would get the idea that appearing is an active verb there. Apparition gives you that. That is, that it is, there's something more active than if it were simply the appearance of these faces in a crowd, which could be a simile. You know, well, the, it has the appearance of something not very happy. But that's not what it's meaning here. It's meaning that they are coming into appearance. The reason ghosts are called apparitions is because they suddenly appear, or they unexpectedly appear. So there's a kind of active verb in that. The word apparition, again, like everything else, appears in Hamlet about the ghost. When the ghost shows up, it's called an apparition. So here's a noun phrase, the apparition of these faces in a crowd. And then here's another noun phrase, petals on a wet black bough. And there's no is, nor is there any other verb indicating how these two noun phrases fit together. They obviously do fit together. It's not that hard to fit them together. But there is no verb which is saying how they fit together. So this is an extremely famous poem. More pages have been written on this poem than you're likely to write as an undergraduate. Many, many, many more pages than you, plural, are likely to write as undergraduates. For this deceptively simple poem. So the question is, if you don't know it, the first thing you're going to notice is that it is a metaphor, right? But now the question is, what is a metaphor for what? So does that question make sense to you? In other words, is this a poem in which the poet, it's Ezra Pound is the poet, is this a poem in which the poet sees faces in a crowd and thinks about petals on a wet black bough? Or what's the other possibility?
He sees petals on a wet black bough, and it reminds him of faces in a crowd.
Yeah. So what do people think? How many people would go with, he sees faces in a crowd and thinks of petals on a wet black bough? And how many people would go with, he sees petals on a wet black bough and thinks of faces in a crowd? That is, they somehow become human faces to him. So, and everyone else is abstaining? All right, if you had to pick, it's like Pascal's wager, you have to pick, you have no choice. Is this about faces, which are metaphorically being compared to petals? How many people think that? Okay, and if you're not raising your hand, it means you're picking the other because you have to pick. Okay, so it's about faces. I mean, it's about petals, which somehow take on the look for him of faces, of maybe what Milton calls the human face divine. Viv, use your hand up, or yeah, go ahead.
And like it's all crowded like on this bough, like in, at least in my mind, to like sort of give it the bridge towards the crowd.
Uh-huh.
I think that you can find like humanity in nature.
Yeah.
And so like he could be looking at the faces of these flowers and thinking of them as like crowded people, like a crowded apparition of faces.
Okay, good. Let me, some of you may know this poem. Just one second, Greg. I just want to read it to you accurately. It's a poem called I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud. Is this not as a crowd, but as a cloud? So it is, I wandered lonely as a cloud. This is a poem by Wordsworth. That floats on high o'er vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils. Beside the lake, beneath the trees, fluttering and dancing in the breeze. Yeah, I'll read you the whole thing because that's what this course is. Continuous as the stars that shine and twinkle on the Milky Way, they stretched in never-ending line along the margin of a bay. 10,000 saw I at a glance, tossing their heads in sprightly dance. The waves beside them danced, but they outdid the sparkling waves in glee. A poet could not but be gay in such a jocund company. I gazed and gazed, but little thought what wealth the show to me had brought. For oft when on my couch I lie in vacant or in pensive mood, they flash upon that inward eye which is the bliss of solitude, and then my heart with pleasure fills and dances with the daffodils. So Pound is almost certainly remembering this poem, thinking of the poem. Flowers, petals, a crowd. For Wordsworth, it's a crowd of flowers, and the metaphor is they're like people, they're faces. They're a company, they're a host. He calls them a jocund company. I like the way you use the word bridge in your description of the metaphor, because that's a metaphorical word. So that would then give you something like, you see petals on a wet black bough, you think of, they're crowded, they're like human faces. They are something that will stay with you the way human faces stay with people. Has Vivi changed anyone's mind about which is which? Okay, so Craig, what were you going to say?
Yeah, I think the reason I chose the first option where the faces and the crowd are mine and the petals and the black bough is because of the order and structure. I think like it's just innate human mind is like, well, the first thing is going to be compared with the second. Though, I mean, in poetry it could be, I don't know if there even is like this sort of rule in poetry, but I think it's inherently in our mind. We look at one, two, and assume one is describing the second.
Okay, so one's the focus, yeah. And one is then the thing, the ellipse that goes around the focus, as we mathematicians like to put it. Massimo, are you?
Kinda, I guess. To sort of go in that same direction, when I think of petals on a wet black bough, I think of a lighter color on top of a darker color sticking out.
Yeah.
And that's what is sort of being said about the faces in a crowd. Like, these faces that you think you see, at least, they stick out to you.
Okay.
Like petals on a wet black bough.
Okay, nice. Now, what if I told you that I've given, this is picking up what Craig said, that I've given these lines, these two noun phrases, I've reversed the order that Pound put them in. So, petals on a wet black bough, the apparition of these faces in a crowd.
Then it might switch for me. I don't know why. Just my mind. Is this really how he put it, or was it? Which one was first?
You'll find out, but not quite yet. You'll also find out the title, but not quite yet. Yeah.
I mean, I think I can see like how the class, I think that the first line could be referring to as human first, then petal, because like what I see is that you focus on the word we use faces, not just like faces in general.
Uh-huh.
Like the apparition of faces in a crowd, the petals, but it's like specifically saying these as if like you're in the moment when you're in the
nice.
Room.
Yeah.
So like you're comparing it to like a memory of petals. Although like I still think like the petals struck me first rather than like that, but like when I do like a bit of further analysis, I can definitely see like where like humanity like comes first rather than like the petal of it.
Okay. All right, let's say, so here are a couple more questions. One is, which would you prefer that it turned out to be? So this is actually a very fast way of talking about a very deep issue in aesthetic interpretation. And to summarize what I think is true, and what I think... we ultimately do. Have you ever had the experience of like really loving a song, like just totally loving it, and then looking up the lyrics, and then the lyrics turned out not as good as you thought they were? That is, you had misheard something, and you're not happy about that because you had heard better lyrics than the song actually had. So I think it's a fact about aesthetic judgment is that we want, when we judge something, if it strikes us at all, we want it to be the best version of what's striking us that it could be. We want it to go one way or another. We want it to be the case. You know, let's say there are two websites that give you lyrics. There's Lyric Genius and there's some other website that's giving you lyrics, and they don't agree. And one gives you the lyrics that you really want it to be, and the other gives you lyrics that it could be but would not be as good. So you're going to prefer the site that gives you the lyrics you want them to be. Like, you've all had that experience too? Mm-hmm. So you're going to prefer the site that you want them to be. I think in general, can you pass this to Alanish? Just pass it down. I think that's a general fact about how we interpret aesthetically. We want it to be as good as it can be. So now the question is, if this poem strikes you at all, which would you prefer? The title is going to tell you which it is. So that's why I'm holding back the title. Which would you prefer was the metaphor, and which would you prefer was the thing that the metaphor is a metaphor for? So here's a way to decide, and maybe a way to make it as good as you can make it. Come up with a title for the poem. You know, titles are usually noun phrases, something you should remember when you write your papers. Titles are usually noun phrases. Think of titles of books, The Catcher in the Rye, The Portrait of a Lady, The Color Purple, Beloved. Those are all nouns. So,
Beloved?
Yeah, Beloved is a character.
That's true. But because I was thinking Beloved in the abstract can also be an adjective.
Yeah, it is but the name is given to a person
right.
Who would be beloved.
Yes.
Sermons, the preacher will address the congregation how? Dearly beloved. That is what the preacher is describing the congregation, how the preacher feels about the congregation. They are dearly beloved. I don't know, Naked and the Dead? Someone come up with a title of a novel that they read in a class. You take...
Scarlet Letter,
okay. Light in August. All right. So come up with a noun phrase as a title for this poem. Just, we'll go around the room. So whoever goes first doesn't have to worry about being preempted. Just any, it would tell you which is which. Like if you were to call this, I don't know, imagine that you have a poem that goes something like sparkling and... a sparkling and a clean drink, the thing I love most in the world. And then the title could either be my beloved erotic partner, or it could be Coca-Cola. No, it wouldn't. It would be Coke. It could be Mountain Dew. So given one of those two titles, you would know whether the poet was saying, I love Mountain Dew the way I love someone that I'm erotically obsessed with, or is the poet saying, I love this person I'm erotically obsessed with all the freshness and caffeine of Mountain Dew. That's how much I love that person. Okay, you start, Craig.
I say petals of faces, but I don't know if that's really going to narrow it down.
Yeah, no, just...
if you want me to narrow it down, I would say petals on a wet black bow, or petals on a bow.
All right, but you already have that line. So give it a noun which tells you what it's about. So essentially, the noun could be something like tree, or it could be, graduation. How did those go? So if it's called tree, what's it about? It's called graduation? Yeah. All right. But those aren't great titles. So better title someone.
I don't know if this would work, but I'm thinking like hauntingly human.
So then it would be about?
It would be about petals because it's saying that they're like faces.
Right. Okay, good. So yeah. Hauntingly human. Good.
Yeah.
Picks up on the word apparition too as ghost.
Yeah.
Good. All right, I'm not going to put you on the spot, but someone else. Yeah, go.
I was going to just say familiar faces.
Okay, there is a poem called Familiar Faces, you know. But okay.
I don't know that, but that's what I'm going with.
All right, so it's faces that look like petals.
Mm.
Okay, anyone else?
I was going to say like the face of flowers, or like flowers and faces.
Yeah, but then you're not, okay, but so flower, it would be of flowers, so flowers would be what it really was.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. No other titles? Okay, so how many people want it to be about faces that look like petals? Yeah, so this is like looking up a lyric. When I give you the title, you'll know what it is. How many people want the title to indicate that it is about faces that look like petals? And how many people want the title to indicate that it's about petals that look like faces? All right, so the title of the poem is In a Station of the Metro. So now you know.
Yeah.
How does it change it?
If you're in a station, you'd be looking at people, not at flowers, because you're in the metro.
Yeah. So it's definitely people. You seemed surprised. It's like not only is it faces, but that's a surprising bunch of faces to compare to petals. Was that your response?
That's kind of what I was thinking. I mean, it's also like, I'm like, oh, it's not the direction I was going with it. So I was like, oh, well, I was wrong. Yeah.
Okay. I think maybe it takes you, if you're going in the other direction, it flips you over more strongly than you might have expected. Because that would actually be an unusual pairing. Faces in a crowd, yeah, okay, they could be faces, you know, outside a crowd of people, watching a soccer game, something like that, but something outdoorsy. That seems to be what they're sharing, is an outdoorsy aspect. And what makes the metaphor stronger, you could say, or more challenging or more demanding, is that it's not outdoors, that the faces in a crowd that are appearing through the window of a subway car are somehow, that is given the fragility and strangeness. There's engineering going on here. There's a subway train, it's underground, there's a whole lot, it's in the middle of a city. And that is a big bridge to the petals.
But like now that it's like underground in a metro, it's a lot more like it's a tighter space, and like then like to me, I'm like, oh, I can definitely see where you're seeing like pedals crowded on a like single bow, like compared to like all these people on the single side of like the subway. So like, that makes it like more like it settles it for me being like, okay, like as a metro, because I couldn't imagine it as like an outdoor crowd and pedals, because I thought that was too wide of a comparison.
Yeah. Okay, neat. Yeah. No, I think that's right. Maybe a way to feel about it is that, unlike with a simile, because part of what we're talking about is the difference between metaphor and simile, that unlike with a simile, when you have a metaphor, there is more of an equal sign between the two things that are being said, one to be the other. So that once you know it's a station at the metro, and the title gives it to you, and you know we're going through this poem in a way different from the way Pound wants us to go through it. He actually worked on this poem for a surprisingly long time. But the title gives you what it's about. Once you know it's a station in the metro, in a sense, the last thing you're expecting is petals on a wet black bough. It's like a station at the metro. Okay, it's a poem. There are going to be metaphors. What's it going to be? Maybe it's going to be ants laboring really hard in an anthill or something like that. But instead, we're brought to a totally different world. Petals on a wet black bough. And it might be that that equal sign, the implicit equal sign, the apparition of these faces in a crowd equals petals on a wet black bough, causes us to jump so much that psychologically it's not clear which has priority. Sort of factually, what has priority is the station of the metro. But psychologically, it's as though the metaphor totally changes your visual image of what this is about. So as I say, we've gone about it in the opposite direction, which is the last visual image that we got were faces in, seen through the window of subway cars. But if you read it in order, take it as a kind of three-line poem where the title is line one. If you read it in order, the surprise is in line three. And line three puts you in a different world. And in a way, the question now is, so which world in the poem has greater force? You wouldn't quite call it reality because it's a poem, but which world has greater force? Is it? If you say A is B, is that a comment about B or is it a comment about A? If you say faces in a crowd are petals on a wet black bough, are you saying what really matters is they're petals on a wet black bough? Or are you saying those faces do everything and more that petals on a wet black bough can do? So sometimes what happens in metaphor is you don't know, you can't necessarily know which way the seesaw will tilt to the thing that is being described by a metaphor or to the metaphor itself, which is another thing that describes the first thing. So, you know, if you think of that time of year, thou mayest in me behold, what we looked at some length on Tuesday, what happens in that poem is that time of life and old age kind of give way to time of year and then to time of day, and then to time of night. And they're all versions of time. But there's another way of putting what happens in that sonnet, is that you talk about a lifetime, and then you talk about a single moment, the now. So you go from all time, all the time that you can expect to live and experience a life, all of which is the word that's used as diachronic, to the single moment of the fire dying out that night. And here again, the question is, so which, in a sense, has priority? Is this, look, life is so short that it's only an instant? Or is it, it's really easy to say life is short, but right now we're thinking about this instant when we're together. The embers are dying, but you still love me. And here we are, and there's this kind of scene of suspension of time. A way of putting it is to say that if you say, sunrise, sunset, swiftly flow the years, one season following another, laden with happiness and?
Tears.
All right, good. Did you know it or did you figure it out?
Right.
Yeah, it's a song from Fiddler on the Roof. That is, wow, look how fast time passes. The other possibility here, again, I want to quote this right. This is Arthur Whaley's translation. So I'm not going to be able to, all right, I'm not going to be able to pronounce this poet's name. It's a Chinese poet whose name is something like Dao Yuan Ming. So, anyone know? Yes, say it right.
Tao Yuan Ming.
Yes, what I was saying, exactly what I was saying. So do you know his famous poem?
He has a lot of famous poems.
Okay, so the most famous of his poems in English, which I'll read you the English translation of, is swiftly the years beyond recall, solemn the stillness of this fair morning. Those are the first two lines. So swiftly the years beyond recall, solemn the stillness of this fair morning. I will clothe myself in spring clothing and visit the slopes of the eastern hill. By the mountain stream, a mist hovers a moment, then scatters. There comes a wind blowing from the south that brushes the fields of new corn. So, time is gone like that. Here we are in this moment, just hovering. So those two ideas of time, that's what you're getting in Shakespeare as well. You're getting simultaneously, life is just like a year, which is just like a day, which is just like a fire going out. Boom, it's gone. But also, here we are. You're loving that well, which thou must leave ere long. Here we are by this fire where we've spent the evening together, where it's warm, even though it's cold outside and the boughs are shaking against the cold. And where we have time to count how many leaves are there, and where things are the now, the moment, the present. And so the metaphor is going to push in one or another direction. It's going to say the metaphor will either illuminate or replace the thing that it's a metaphor for. And if it replaces it, then something really interesting has happened. And I think that's what Pound is trying to do, is to get it to replace the thing that it's a metaphor for. It's not like, oh yeah, they do look like petals on a wet black bough. How interesting subways are. But you see those faces in the crowd, and then you think of something completely different. And the faces bring you to that different thing that you think of. So take a look in the sonnet that I just, in the sheet that I just sent you, the second sonnet in that sheet by Alice Oswald, is a kind of, it's a really interesting sonnet about simile and metaphor. Does someone want to read it? That's the one that I just... Does anyone need another copy?
The Alice Oswald?
Yeah.
I'll read it.
Okay, go for it.
From time to time, our love is like a sail. And when the sail begins to alternate from tack to tack, it's like a swallowtail. And when the swallow flies, it's like a coat. And if this coat is yours, it has a tear, like a wide mouth. And when the mouth begins to draw the wind, it is like a trumpeteer. And when the trumpet blows, it blows like millions. And this, my love, when millions come and go, beyond the need of us, is like a trick. And when the trick begins, it's like a toe, tiptoeing on a rope, which is like luck. And when the luck begins, it is like a wedding, just like luck, just like everything.
Thank you. Beautifully read. So, what's the first thing you notice? Simile or metaphor?
Simile.
Yeah. From time to time, our love is like a sail. Does that simile make sense?
No.
I think it does.
Okay, go.
Love can, like, blow strong, like in a sail. Like, it can get, like, big pushes, or it can, like, grow a bit flat, like, you know? And, like, the sail, like, can tear, like, things can happen to it. But it's, like, an essential... If love is not only the sail, but also the boat, the sail is an essential part to, like, the love. And if the sail tears, there's a big problem on that boat.
Okay. The coat is going to tear. It may not be the sail. But okay, that makes sense. But it's still an odd thing to say immediately from time to time, our love is like a sail. But it also might be, you know, it pushes us far, we raise the sail, it takes us somewhere. Okay, so from time to time, our love is like a sail. One thing you're going to do in a sonnet is you're going to say, okay, let's see where this is going to go. So from time to time, our love is like a sail. And when the sail begins to alternate from tack to tack. So what does that mean? Just what's the image there?
Like wind direction, getting a sail.
Yeah. Has anyone ever sailed on a sailboat? Do you know what it means to tack? Were you nodding? No. Okay, do you know how you sail into the wind? Did you know you can do that? That the wind can be blowing at you, and yet with a sailboat you can still go in the general direction from which the wind is coming? You ever wonder how that can happen? So what you do is you tack back and forth. So the wind hits the sail, the boat has a keel, there are two vectors, and the boat can go diagonally with respect to the wind. So it goes diagonally this way, and then it tacks in the other direction, and it's still going generally forward, but through zigzagging diagonal motion. So that's called tacking if you are on a sailboat. So from time to time, our love is like a sail. And when the sail begins to alternate from tack to tack, that is, it goes this way and that way, what's happened in line two?
Kind of a metaphor.
Yeah, the simile became a metaphor in line two. So from time to time, our love is like a sail. and when the sail begins to alternate from tack to tack. Anything else interesting about from tack to tack?
Yeah, it rhymes with from time to time.
Yeah, it echoes from time to time. So you get from time to time, which turns into from tack to tack. So from time to time is just, you know, occasionally. But now it turns out, in a way, the very idea is becoming more metaphorically when it becomes from tack to tack. So from time to time, our love is like a sail. And when the sail begins to alternate from tack to tack, that is alternate back and forth, it's like a swallowtail. What's a swallowtail?
Some bird, right?
No, that would be a swallow. Anyone have any associations with swallowtail?
I thought it was like the bird.
So she's going to use it as a bird's tail, but you would use it as swallow space tail if you're talking about the tail of a swallow. Like, have you ever seen the word pigeon tail or bluebird tail or dovetail? You have seen, but that's a verb. So swallowtail is kind of butterfly.
Oh.
So it is like a butterfly that's hopping around from flower to flower the way butterflies do. So it's like a swallowtail, and then it turns into a swallow in the next line. And when the swallow flies, so it's as though the swallowtail butterfly is being made into a metaphor for the tail of a swallow, which is really interesting. That the butterfly looks like the tail of a swallow, but it's a butterfly, and that's what she's talking about. And we know she's talking about it because it's moving the way a butterfly does, alternating from tack to tack, moving the way a butterfly does. And when the swallow flies, so suddenly the butterfly that looks like the tail of a swallow becomes the tail of a swallow, and you can see the swallow flying. And when the swallow flies, it's like a coat. So, does that make sense? Yeah, the swallow flies and it's like a coat? So how does she get away with that?
Maybe it like, looks like one somehow, I don't know.
A coat of feathers?
A coat of feathers, okay. Looks like a coat. It's an odd simile. It certainly doesn't seem like a flying swallow would be like a coat. But there is such a thing. Yeah. Okay, so let me go to Google Images, because what she's doing here, I like that, and it may be the source of this, but so, this, see this guy? See the bottom? He's like, that's called a swallowtail coat.
Wait, which one, the right?
This one. I mean, this is all Google Images for swallowtail coat. So a swallowtail coat is basically a very formal coat. It's when people are wearing white tie and tails. One style of tails, if your jacket has tails, is called a swallowtail. So we've gotten three swallowtails in a row. We've gotten the swallowtail butterfly, which is like a flying swallow, which is like a coat. But what are making those connections there is almost that they're homonyms. Not quite, because they do look like each other. The swallowtail butterfly looks like the tail of a swallow. Then the swallow itself flies. But because we're talking about swallowtails, we're also talking about formal men's clothing that you would wear if you are wearing men's clothing just once in your life you wear a swallowtail, where would you be wearing it?
Wedding.
At your wedding, yeah. So here we are getting back to the title, wedding.
Do you refresh what a homonym is? I don't, I've heard it, I forget what it is.
Homonym is there and there and there, or two, two, and two.
So similar sounding words that mean different things.
Yes, so same, nim means name. So literally it means same name. So a synonym is something that names something similar. Okay, so, and if the coat is yours, it has a tear like a wide mouth. Where does that tear come from? Maybe it's the person she's addressing. In a way, we're so bewildered now by all these similes that we may not quite wonder where the tear is coming from. How do you know it's not tear?
Yeah, I read it as tear first. It's trumpeteer.
Yeah. So a tear like a wide mouth doesn't quite work, but for a minute it might flicker there.
Or it could be working as both.
Yeah. So in the same way that swallowtail has worked as both, mm-hmm. or as three things. So if the coat is yours, it has a tear. It's a wedding. You're crying. I'm not crying, you're crying.
I mean, you definitely have, if you're crying like profusely, you might have a wide mouth. I mean, you're exclaiming to the world.
Okay, but would a tear be like a wide mouth?
No.
But maybe there's a kind of overlap in atmosphere there. Okay. And when the mouth begins to draw the wind, so notice it's like a coat, and now we have the coat. It's like a mouth, but now we have the mouth. And the mouth begins to draw the wind, begins to breathe, begins to inhale, and then what it's like a trumpeter. And when the trumpet blows, it blows like millions. So what's millions rhyming with?
Begins?
Yeah. An odd rhyme there.
Yeah.
It blows like millions. And this, my love, when millions come and go beyond the need of us, is like a trick. So, very bewildering what's going on with the metaphors here. But millions come and go, all these crowds, like petals on a wet black bough. The trumpet blows like millions, and millions come and go, and more than we need, or more than need us. But it's like a trick. And when the trick begins, what trick? The trick that millions coming and going somehow represent. When the trick begins, it's like a toe tiptoeing on a rope.
Maybe love is the trick that millions experience?
Yeah, or a circus, a high wire act, a toe tip towing on a rope, maybe a crowd in a circus, which is like luck, so that you don't fall, which is like luck. And when the luck begins, it's like a wedding. So that's when everything comes round again to the title. It's like a wedding. And what's a wedding like? Which is like love. And what's love like? It's like everything. And what does the poem, all these similes and metaphors suggest?
You're getting married.
Yeah, but also that when love is the experience, then love can be compared to everything. The poem has kind of gone through a catalog of everything. Things that you would never... how to put this? In set theory, as I'm sure you expected me to say, there's an argument about how to define a set. So you all know what sets are, right? If you talk about the set of students in this class or the set of students who are here today, it would be a list of everyone who's here today. If you talk about the set of buildings at Brandeis, it would be all the list of all the buildings at Brandeis. So there are two ways of describing a set. One is always right, and it's called the extensional description of a set. And that just means you list the elements. And a set can contain, well, there's a very famous one in Borges. Let me just give you this one. Do people know who Borges are? Is?
Yeah, he's a Spanish, or I think
Argentinian.
Yeah. He writes in Spanish.
Yeah. Say it again.
Labyrinth.
Oh, Labyrinth, yes. Oh, that's too bad. Okay. Too many people know this passage, so it's hard to Google. Damn it. Okay. If this doesn't work. Okay, here. So, so here is a set called Animals Innumerable, and the members of this set include animals belonging to the emperor, animals that are embalmed, tame animals, suckling pigs, sirens, fabulous animals, stray dogs, animals included in the present classification, frenzied animals, and animals drawn with a very fine camel hair brush, etc., animals that have just broken the water pitcher, and animals that from a long way off look like flies. Okay, so that would be a list of things that seem to have nothing to do with each other except that they're animals, but a list of things that don't have very much to do with each other. And you can do something like that. You can say pencils, oceans, elevators, shoes. And that's a set, perfectly fine set. A set containing a pencil, an ocean, an elevator, and a shoe. Perfectly fine set. But there's really nothing about them that makes them seem naturally to go together. So the intentional definition of a set is something like all people who are taller than 5 feet tall, or all people who are younger than 23. And then you would know that every member of the set would be a person younger than 23. Or every member of the set would be a person who is taller than 5 feet tall. And you would know things without having to have the list of what's in the set. The other kind of set is one where you can only define the set by a list. You have to know every member to know what the set is. So generally, we would think of metaphors or a figurative language as things that, yeah, they naturally do fall into the same set. That is, that the person I love and roses and sugar and violets, that's a well-formed set. Why? Because these are all really sweet, wonderful things. So the set brings together, you can say what these things have in common is that they're sweet and wonderful. And then what makes it a metaphor is that I am saying that the person I love belongs to a set that looks natural if you say it's got sugar and honey and roses and violets and things like that in it. Then when I add the person I love to that set, it's immediately clear what I'm saying, which is the person that I love is in that set because they have the same qualities, even if only metaphorically, they have the same qualities as the other members of the set. This sonnet challenges that, because all the things in the sonnet, they don't seem to have any similar qualities to each other, except that you can step from one to the other, like stepping on stones as you're crossing a brook or something like that. You can step from one to the other, and then it circles back. And so what is the point of having what are essentially a bunch of similes and metaphors that, like in the Borges list, don't seem to have anything to do with each other? Why would she write the poem this way? Well, I think it's the last two words, which is like love, which is like everything. That is that the experience of love is that everything is great, is what the poem seems to be saying. The experience of love is it goes everywhere and it can transfigure and transform everything. So part of, I think it's a surprisingly wonderful poem, and it's partly wonderful because it is surprising, because you certainly aren't going to anticipate any of the next metaphors or similes that she comes with. From time to time, our love is like a sail, which is like a swallowtail, which is like a coat, which has a tear, which is like a mouth, which a trumpeter might trumpet through, which is like millions, which is like a trick, which is like walking on a tightrope, which is like luck, which is like a wedding, which is like love. So that gets you back to the beginning. Ultimately, it's our love is like love. It's A equals B equals C equals D equals E equals F equals A. So simplify that, A equals A, which is like everything. And then that's how all of this is gathered together into the single sonnet. Okay, let us go to, I think which sonnet we should do next. One of the sonnets, let's look at the sonnet by George Starbuck. So it's, I think, on your last page. We're not going to go through it in detail because to work out the meaning of every line is... will take a while, but just notice what it's called. George Starbuck is the guy who wrote the Space Saver sonnet, remember? To think Lou Dink and Miss Landis dead, you do steady me. So he wrote a bunch of those. He's the guy who ruined his career with the acrostic. Here's a sonnet called Sonnet with a Different Letter at the End of Every Line. What's interesting about that? Yeah.
It is the same letter beginning of every line.
Okay, so every line begins with the letter O. Mm-hmm. So he's saying the end of every line has a different letter. If you're writing a rhymed poem, how easy is it to have a different letter at the end of every line?
Hard.
Why?
Because it's like, I mean, night and light, you know, like it always just has to have the last, it has to be the same for it to rhyme.
Yeah. So you could say, so since sonnets are going to have at least seven pairs of rhymes, you would say, okay, maybe a sonnet whose lines end with seven different letters. That would make sense. So you could do light and right in the first, would be the A rhymes, would be light and right, and the B rhymes would be, let's just look at... Milton, so saint and faint, they both end with T. Grave and gave, they both end with V-E. Taint and restraint, again, going back to saint and faint, end with T. And save and have, end with V-E. Then mind and shined, end with D. Sight and delight, end with T. and inclined and night, and again with D and T. So they're like, what, four different letters at the ends of those lines. Here you have 14. How many letters in the English alphabet?
26.
Yeah, so you're going through a lot of different letters. If you play Wordle, it's a little bit like doing Wordle and getting no hits in your first two lines, which is really cool when you can do that. But these are going to rhyme. Now, it's not impossible. You can rhyme C with belly and or I with symmetry, to use Blake's famous either rhyme or not rhyme. And one ends with E, one ends with Y. So it's not impossible, but it's just hard. Okay, so here is this sonnet. Every line begins with O. O for a muse of fire. Anyone know where that's from? That's a quotation, actually. So those are the first words of Shakespeare's play, Henry V. O for a muse of fire to ascend, says the chorus in Henry V. He, the chorus, wants to have a muse that will make this play really powerful. So Starbuck is quoting that. O for a muse of fire, a sack of dough. Oh, or both. Oh, promissory notes of woe. So here you have a perfect rhyme, right? What's the rhyme scheme for the first two lines? A-A. And different letters, though, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's not that hard. Mm. One time in Santa Fe,
Mexico.
All right, so here's another letter at the end of the line is M, but the rhyme is A. So one time in Santa Fe, New Mexico, oh, Winfield, Townley, Scott, and I, but whoa, ending with A. One can exert oneself. Anyone know? Musicians? What does double F mean?
Fortissimo.
It means play it very loud. So one can exert oneself fortissimo. If you're reading music and you see a double F, you pronounce it fortissimo. One can exert oneself fortissimo or architect a heaven like Rimbaud. People know who Rimbaud was? A French poet, a 19th century French poet, regarded as one of the great French poets who stopped writing poetry at the age of 17. So it's too late for you to be Rimbaud. Or architect a heaven like Rimbaud, or if that seems, how shall I say?
De trop.
That is too much, because French. One can at least write sonnets.
Apropos.
Of nothing save the...
Do-re-mi-fa-so.
Of poetry itself. Remember, that's what we're talking about, how all poems are about poetry and about themselves. Is not the row of perfect rhymes the terminal... Bon mot, that means right word. The bon mot means the right word. Obeisance enough to the great O, that is the great O of poetry. And then a little scene, observe, said Chairman Mao to Premier Cho. Everyone know who that was? Who was it?
What year was he writing this?
Starbuck? 70s.
Oh, it's talking about Mao.
That Mao. And do people know who Chou En-lai was? He was the premier. He was one of Mao's, the second most powerful person, if not the most powerful person at the time. So observe, said Chairman Mao to Premier Chou. Can you read the next two lines, Julian?
Yes, because they're in French. On voyage à Parnasse pour prendre des eaux. On voyage comme poisson. And it's incog.
It's enco.
Enco
is how you say it in French. Right. It's like okay in English. It's a French abbreviation, which is pronounced enco, and it's an abbreviation for incognito. So you go to Mar Panaces for the waters, and you voyage there like a fish, without anyone knowing who you are. So you do it incognito. All right, so you don't have to worry too much about the content of this poem. all it has to do really is to make sense because it's about its own form. And that form is a different letter at the end of every line. But what's the rhyme scheme?
A-A-A-A-A.
Yeah. Keep going?
14 times.
Yeah. Okay, so amazing. A sonnet, 14 that rhymes, has only one rhyme, but uses over half the letters of the alphabet to end each line. So pretty amazing. Anything disappointing about it?
He cheated. He used different languages.
Yeah. That's okay. I mean, okay, so he cheated. Fine, you can be disappointed by that. Anything, but cut him some slack. Anything else disappointing? If you were doing it, what might you not do?
New Mexico.
Okay, why not?
Because it invokes the rhyme. It doesn't actually do it.
Well, if you're reading aloud, though.
I would say Anna.
Don't you say New York, New York? And you don't say New York?
I say New York, NY.
Do you?
No.
Yeah, all right. There you go. Waltham, Mass, but not Ma. Yeah. Massachusetts is long. What? Okay, let's give it to him that he did this really cool thing, legit cool thing, which is to have a single rhyme with 14 different letters. Can you imagine a slight thing you would have preferred? Tiny, tiny thing. What do we think, let me just ask you this, what do we think about the last line of the second stanza, obeisance enough to the great O? Not use O at all. Wouldn't it be even cooler if the rhyme sound was never the last letter? That would be even cooler. Remember all those O's in the James Merrill poem in Body? The 18 O's? So wouldn't it be even cooler if he only had the 14 O's at the left and no O at all in the right? How many O's? Zero in the right. Wouldn't that be even cooler? So I actually once said that in a lecture, and someone raised their hand and said, you got fooled. So can you see how I might have gotten fooled?
Oh, is it times with a...
Say it again?
Does it, I mean, it ends with a question mark, though.
Oh, no, that... Yeah, okay, but they're punctuation marks at the end of other lines also. It's a letter at the end of the line. Okay, first stanza, how many lines?
Four.
Last stanza, how many?
Three.
So that's seven. How many should be in the middle stanza?
Seven.
How many are there?
Eight.
How many lines in this sonnet?
15.
So what he knew was that someone like me was going to say, oh, this is so great, but I would have done it even better. I wouldn't have used the letter O at all if I could. And what does he do? He knows that at some point someone is going to have that kind of obnoxious, self-serving thought, and then they're going to realize, actually, there are 15 lines in this so-called sonnet. And that he did do a sonnet without even, he could have done a sonnet without using the letter O at all. And that's a little Easter egg in the sonnet too.
Oh, I see. So like if you remove that obeisance enough to the great O, it would be a real sonnet, but he left it there just kind of piss you off.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And to make me feel like, yeah, you know, yeah, we're two people who are thinking about these cool poems, and you know, you had a cool thought, and I have a cool thought too. And it was like, actually, your cool thought was totally derivative, and I predicted it, and I set a little trap for you here. So that's what he did. But again, notice that what's happening here is that the demands of rhyme and the demands of form are creating the metaphors. So rhyme will create metaphor. If you need to rhyme something, you may go to a metaphor that the content of which will enable you to do that rhyming. Let's look at Let's see. Let's look at the Bishop poem. So, as I say, it's easier to look at in the handout that I gave today. Called Some Dreams They Forgot. It's a very mysterious poem. It's about dreaming. Just trying to think if we should really do this now. Okay, yeah. So, dreams. The dead birds fell. Remember, this is a dream. The dead birds fell, but no one had seen them fly or could guess from where. They were black, their eyes were shut, and no one knew what kind of birds they were, but all held them and looked up through the new far-funneled sky. So again, it's kind of dream logic, but you can picture it, that dead black birds are falling down and no one knew what kind of birds they were, but people pick them up. And now the sky is far funneled because there are no longer birds there coating the sky, blanketing the sky. Also, dark drops fell. Night collected on the eaves or congregated on the ceilings over the beds. They hung, mysterious drop shapes, all night over their heads, now rolling off their careless fingers, quick as dew off leaves. Where had they seen woodberries perfect as these, shining just so in the early morning? Dark-hearted decoys on upper bough or below leaf. Had they thought poison and left, or remember eaten them from the loaded trees? So first 12 lines, I think, gives you a really good description of dream lucidity. You know, how dreams are foggy and opaque when you wake up, but one of the strange things about that is how lucid they are when you're dreaming them, and you can remember that lucidity. And so here it's not quite surreal because it's just too lucid, but it's all very strange. And then the question, another question, what flowers shrink to seeds like these, like columbine? So columbine, when it becomes a seed, becomes, it's almost like dirt. It shrinks to just little black points. So the flower just shrinks to something that's like dirt. What flowers shrink to seeds like these, like columbine? But their dreams are all inscrutable by 8 or 9. So what's the rhyme scheme? Did you notice it rhymed, by the way? Did everyone notice it rhymed? It may not be obvious at first. What's the rhyme scheme?
A-B-B-A.
A-B-B-A, yep,
there's
then.
There's a weird thing later.
Sorry?
There's a weird part later.
Yeah, which is the weird part?
Like, just A-B-B-A, and C.
D-D-C.
C, and then C again, right?
You're thinking of these as rhyming with eaves?
Yeah.
And leaves.
Yeah.
So yeah, it could be an off rhyme. I think that's part of the effect of it. So technically, they don't rhyme. These and eaves don't rhyme, but they're close. They're assonance. So, and then what do you think of the rhyme decoys on and poison? Yeah, which you wouldn't, but it's still a pretty cool rhyme. The rhymes here are not, they don't stand out. They're not saying, look at us, we rhyme, the way ballad rhymes do. But they're there. How long are the lines? Are they iambic pentameter? Craig, I think you were asking about that the other day. No, not at all. The dead birds fell, but no one had seen them fly. How many syllables? Uh-huh. Or could guess from where they were black, their eyes were shut. Uh-huh. What do we call that? An Alexandrine. And no one knew what kinds of birds they were, but. So the rhymes are pretty well hidden, partly because the lines are longer, partly because of the enjambments. And, yeah, dark-hearted decoys on upper bough or below leaf, had they thought poison? That's probably the rhyme you'll notice least. And then the line at the end, the couplet at the end, definitely you notice the rhyme. What flowers shrink to seeds like these, like columbine? And then the dream is over, but their dreams are all inscrutable by 8 or 9. What does inscrutable mean? Yeah, that you can't make sense of it, not because it's chaotic, but because it is being completely unyielding of its sense. If you say that someone is inscrutable, it means you don't know what they're thinking. But the title is Some Dreams They Forgot. So one question you might ask is, who are they? And how do their dreams become inscrutable? It's a good description of what will sometimes happen in dreams, which is that you wake up into a normal world, but there was this strange other world that was lucid and there, and now it's still there, but not you. It's not letting you into it anymore. What do you think those last words mean, by 8 or 9? 8 a.m., 9 a.m. Yeah. So you're dreaming all night, now it's 8 or 9 a.m. Your dreams have become inscrutable, it's time to wake up. How many times a night do you dream?
I guess there's...
Okay, there's a standard answer to that, though.
14.
nice.
8 or 9.
8 or 9 times. Yeah, if you look at REM sleep, people have 8 or 9 periods of REM sleep in a good night's sleep.
You shouldn't get that much.
Yeah. So REM sleep is, everyone know?
Rapid eye movement
sleep. How old are you when your dreams become your earlier dreams... become inscrutable.
8 or 9.
Yeah. That is that there are memories that we have of early childhood where we were somehow more lucid and less emotional than now. Lots of your memories of early childhood are being emotional, but you were also really observant. And even when you were emotional, there was a part of you that was just watching. And that part is, in a way, what's being evoked by these dreams. Strange, but not scary. Strange, but not emotional. Strange, precise, lucid, and not what poems usually are about, which are emotions. And then by the time you're 8 or 9, you've become a normal person. And those dreams, they're forgotten. But somehow there's still that memory of a kind of lucidity which is now inscrutable to you. And the poem, I think, evokes that really, really well. And it partly does so because it can do what, because rhymes do what dreams do, which is make really precise and strong connections between things that are not connected. And that's what dreams, a certain kind of lucid, inscrutable dreaming does as well. And I think she's just really good at evoking that in this poem. If evocation is the right word, it may not even be, of reminding us of that, but only barely in this poem. Okay, have a good weekend. See you Tuesday. Bye.